You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on the 20th of February. That is 4 days before those blessed 24 hours when we're given respite from arguably the most tedious social media meme in cycling, because it will in fact be 0 days until Omloop. My name's Daniel Freiber and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will try not to get irrationally wound up about such minor online annoyances and instead serenely look back on the last 7 days in professional cycling with another eye on what's to come. Rob Hatch, Eurosport commentator and very regular guest in these parts. It'll soon be happy Omloop Day, another pet hate of mine. Rob, I'm feeling very cantankerous. I've been very wound up this week. I don't know what it is. Why am I so cantankerous?
You wound up? Never. I'm not having that. That doesn't happen to you.
Rob, we're going to... I'll tell you what. We'll welcome our second guest co-host, and then we will each talk about, or you two can tell me if there's any, internet cycling memes that wind you up. So also joining us this week, after he successfully avoided the life ban I threatened him with, if you mentioned track cycling last week, it is young, still young, I think, forever young, Richard Abraham.
Good morning, Daniel. Is that still hanging over me as a constant sort of the T word in the background for the rest of...
Track cycling, yes. That is an inviolable, is that a word, policy on the cycling podcast.
Okay. I'm just constantly on probation now for forever.
Yes, and cyclocross as well. You're not allowed to mention cyclocross until, I would like to say, well, next January, but probably around November. Okay. We'll grudgingly have to bring it up again. Chaps, is there any internet memes that bug you irrationally? And this is no slight on people who have posted these memes in the past. It's just the 0 days until Omloop. I see it as slightly disrespectful to the rest of the calendar. That's what it is. It's as though nothing else matters except opening weekend in Belgium. I think also my heckles have been raised this week by the Alpecin De Koninck kit launch. Another thing that cycling clothing, cycling kits don't generally grind my gears. It's not a topic that I'm particularly interested in. However, when Alpecin De Koninck unveiled a kit that was a rip-off of the Carrera kit from 30 years ago, and B, identical to their big rivals Sudal Quick Steps kit, that wound me up. And I don't know, Rob, maybe that was a shot across Sudal Quickstep's bowels, because we know they already stole a sponsor, and now they've stolen their look.
And they've stolen the classics reputation in the last couple of years as well, winning the big races. But I like the kit, Daniel. I'd wear it, but I completely agree on the second point. From a work point of view, it's an absolute nightmare for us commentators.
And the Carrera kit, obviously, was inspired by the denim that Carrera make and still make. In fact, you can still buy Carrera jeans in Italian service stations. I bought a nice Carrera t-shirt, retro t-shirt, in an Italian service station on the Giro a couple of years ago. So there was good reason for that. You know, if De Koninck wanted to go down that road, we should have had pictures of its double glazing, isn't it? Or bottles of shampoo
and double glazing
on the kit. So it's not imaginative. It doesn't seem to fit with any particular narrative. So chaps, Alpecin De Koninck kit, does it? Well, Rob, we know it doesn't annoy you. And secondly, internet cycling memes, please.
I think to chime in on the kit, I think back in the 90s, when cycling had a bit less of a sort of technical, like Formula One on two wheels kind of spirit to it, like a denim kit went all right. Like, it kind of fitted with the narrative of a bit kind of Euro poppy, exciting, bright, fashionably unfashionable. But now, like, it's the way that cycling is moving, and it from a technological point of view, and the way that it's presenting itself, sort of scientific, professionalized, highly focused, does not fit with like denim lycra. The two just clash in a very bad way for me.
Not baggy jeans then, is it?
You can come again. I mean, another sort of similar kit in a similar vein was the Castorama kit with sort of mock overalls. Castorama, of course, is like a DIY store. Big Matt also had a very similar one, which with sort of mock overalls on the front. cycling memes, chaps?
I still can't get over you have to call them a meme. It just doesn't look right. It's a meme, isn't it?
You know, things that people say regularly become a little bit hackneyed and cliched.
I, for one, am glad I don't do X, as it's called nowadays, anymore. Okay. So I get away with most of that. But the one where the bloke's looking back and he's with his girlfriend and he's looking at another woman, that does my head in, not for any particular reason, apart from the fact that I saw it 55 million times.
Oh, you're such a nice boy, Rob. I'm just looking at this theme of the very sort of visual, descriptive kits in sport generally. There have been a few in Spanish football. There's one, I forget which team it is, whose kit consists of entirely of sort of jamón ibérico, pictures of jamón ibérico, that is the whole, so it's deep red, so hams. And there's another one in a Spanish third division team called La Hoya, who play in a kit which is just one big photo of sort of a broccoli plantation, if that's the correct word. It's just lots of broccoli on the kit, which I think has something to do with the sponsors. Anyway, chaps, it feels as though we really should...
Shall we talk about some proper cycling now?
Yeah, stop talking nonsense. And let's get on, shall we, to the news roundup, which traditionally starts all of our episodes on the Cycling Podcast, certainly during the season. We will go chronologically, chaps. Last week, there was one stage to go, I believe, in the Tour of Oman when we recorded. It was the decisive stage to the summit of Green Mountain, and it was won, like the GC, by Adam Yates of UAE Team Emirates. Won very convincingly, pretty easily, I would say. Second was Jan Hirt of Sudal Quickstep and Czechia, Rob.
Yes, well said.
And third was Yates' UAE teammate, Finn Fisher-Black, one of the many revelations of the 2024 season to date, I would suggest. Fisher-Black also won the points competition, the youth jersey, young riders jersey, and UAE won the team's jersey. Chaps, we will just dwell on this for a moment because I don't think we'll talk much about the Tour of Oman in part two. Adam Yates' record in stage races, it bears mentioning and dissecting, analysing just for a moment. He's won 7 stage race GCs in his career, 18 top threes, 30 top fives, 37 top tens, and this is in 62 stage races in his pro career. So in over half of them, he's finished in the top 10. In almost half of them, he's finished in the top 5. I remember a couple of years ago, I called him Craig David after the British R&B star, famous, among other things.
How did that go down?
Well, no, I didn't. Not to his face, obviously. Because Craig David had a famous song called 7 Days. Adam Yates, I thought, was the king of short stage races, 7-day racing. One incredible record, chaps. Bears out once again that Adam Yates, were he not at UAE Team Emirates, would be a viable option, I think, certainly to win a Grand Tour in the near future. Who knows, he may yet win one for UAE Team Emirates.
I had that question put to me by another journalist the other day, actually, about kind of what's Adam Yates doing at UAE, and surely he could go and win a Grand Tour somewhere else. And then you're thinking, well, like, what team would he go to do that? And would that team be good enough now to win a Grand Tour? I think Adam Yates is good enough to do it from his stage racing record, although it's not really fair to draw too many parallels between them. But we know Simon's won a Grand Tour, he won the Vuelta. So, but then the way that teams now have to set up and operate in order to try and win a Grand Tour, where would he go to do that?
Well, think about the mess that Ineos got themselves in last year, in the summer of last year, when they had to pivot and make a U-turn over Carlos Rodriguez, and they basically had to, well, they've anointed him, really, I suppose you could say Tom Pidcock as well, but they've anointed Rodriguez as the man most likely and the man they're currently, in this period, going to build their GC hopes around. Is Adam Yates the one that got away? Because, of course, the previous year he'd done the Tour de France as one of three leaders at the Tour de France, but he was sort of the lesser one, the least of the three. I remember the time trial in Copenhagen where he didn't get the same equipment. It was Thomas and, remind me, who would have been the other leader? Was it Dani Martinez? And Yates, as I say, he was sort of, I'm not going to say the sort of bastard sibling of the three, but they didn't get completely behind him, and I don't know. Was he the big mistake that they made in terms of their sort of grand tour planning over the last two or three years? It's possible, something to conjure with.
I would say so. In fact, I was reading an article, I think it was in Rouleau over the winter, and he was being very diplomatic. You know, he's well-mannered bloke, and he didn't want to come out swinging and criticise, but there are enough hints in what he said to say that he did leave Ineos and he feels more valued where he is now at UAE. He did say that there's now less politics involved in what people want to race for. They're all allowed to say they would like to race for whether they get given. That's another thing, but the team takes into account what the riders want to do at UAE, and it seems to have pretty much everybody fairly happy at the minute, doesn't it? I mean, it'd be interesting to see what happens at the Tour this year with all the superstars going. But then again, you know, Tadej Pogacar is so good that if he's on the money, none of them are really going to turn around and argue and say, hang on a minute, I deserve to be the leader instead of him, are they? But I think...
He's never had a go at the Giro, and the Giro is the one that looks on paper to be best suited to him, because as the years have passed, he's become more and more of a pure climber, I would say, or recognised, got the recognition he deserves as a pure climber. And, that is the climber's Grand Tour par excellence. Certainly it was until this year, when it's been watered down slightly, maybe to find favour with Pogacar. Chaps, should we move on again? Proceeding in chronological order, I think last week we were one stage into the Volta Algarve, Herbin Theisen having triumphed on day one. The following day, Dani Martinez won on the Alto da Foya. Martinez, who I think I said to Rob Hatch in a text that day, can look like Lance Armstrong one day and Louis Armstrong the next, unfortunately. He has been quite inconsistent. When he's good, he's outstanding. And we saw that last week. The following day, Wout van Aert took his first road win of the season, to be followed by his countryman Remco Evenepoel winning the TT ahead of an outstanding Magnus Sheffield and Stefan Kung the following day. This gave Remco a lead of 47 seconds going into the last stage showdown atop the Alto do Maliao, and he duly defended it, though not without Van Aert and Ben Healy giving him and Sudal Quickstep a nervous half hour or so, and not without Martinez again out-sprinting Remco for his second stage win. Chaps, we're going to talk a lot more about that race in part two, I believe, so we'll move on. It's been a tradition for a while now for the Volta Algarve and the Ruta del Sol to run concomitantly at the same time. That was due to be the case this year as well, Rob. But what happened? Well, go on, Rob. You tell us.
I think a lot of people who've been reading the news all over Europe know there's a lot of protests going on in the agricultural sector right now. We saw it in France in stage racing. It's come to Spain in the last 2 weeks. There have been big protests on the Spanish mainland, in Catalonia mainly, parts of the Basque Country, and then down south in Andalusia. And in Andalusia, there was also a very tragic incident, actually, in which a couple of police officers were killed in a drugs bust on a boat down near Cadiz. This didn't really get in the news, but it made part of the decision that was then made about the Andalusia, it made a lot of sense, because there were basically not enough Guardia Civils, not enough police officers to keep the route safe, unfortunately. And it meant that aside from a 5 kilometre time trial, we had no racing in Andalusia. It was a real disappointment for the organisers. And the organiser was visibly upset when he was given the announcement. And, you know, they're one of the few independent organisers left, aren't they? And I really felt for them.
Yeah, the organizer Joaquin Cuevas, they've already had to sort of save the race once about 10 years ago. The race was in a pretty bad way, as a lot of small stage races in Spain, and they tried various things, crowdfunding. They really shook up the route. If you go back and look at results from the Ruta del Sol from 20, 30 years ago, this was a sprinter's race. I remember one year when I think Alessandro Petacchi, the Italian sprinter, won almost every stage, and they made it exciting, didn't they? I think they reduced it to 4 days initially, and they introduced a lot of mountains, and Andalusia is very mountainous, and there's some fantastic climbs there, and they used them, and it saw some great duels between Chris Froome, Contador, and there was a good field this year as well. And well, we just hope that race is on the calendar again next year because they will have taken a big hit, won't they?
Yeah, and there was real disappointment for Carlos Rodriguez as well because the first stage was due to start from his hometown of Almuñeca. So I felt for him and Luis Angel Mate racing his final.
The Lynx.
He'll be at the Vuelta at least, though.
He will be at the Vuelta. We look forward to seeing him at the Vuelta. Actually, Rob, I didn't include that in the news roundup, but I think that did occur after we recorded last week that the Vuelta announced the two wild cards for this year's race, and they are Wescali, and
Kern Farmer.
So the other two, the two Spanish Pro Conti teams that were invited last year, Burgos Biache, and the other one is Caja Rural, they miss out this year. So the Vuelta organisers, that's kind of been the way of things, hasn't it, for a few years now? They've sort of rotated.
It has, but Burgos have been on a good run, I think. And again, it probably has something to do with the fact that the Burgos has sponsored parts of the Vuelta and they've had sort of Gran Salida there and things like that. But Burgos has been on a 5 or 6 year run, so it's probably time for them to sit on the bench for one.
Happily, one other stage race did finish in Spain at the weekend. It was the Women's Semana Ciclista de la Comunidad Valenciana. Four stages. They were won by Elisa Balsamo, Marlon Reusser, Niamh Fisher-Black, and Balsamo again. And Reusser won the GC by 8 seconds over Katarzyna Niewiadoma, or Cassia, as she's more commonly known. I've noticed an increasing trend to give her a full name, a proper name, Katarzyna, not Cassia.
Is that correct?
Recently. Yeah, I believe so.
Katarzyna.
Yeah, to complete the roundup as far as results are concerned, we go to the south of France, the Var Département specifically. There we saw the premiere of a new race, the Var Classic, finishing atop Montferrand. Very welcome return to one of the sacred places of French cycling. Maybe we'll talk about that a bit more later on. The race was won and lost in somewhat tragicomic fashion. Lost by Tobias Johannessen, who was the victim of some premature exaltation. And the race was won by local boy Lenny Martinez. That race, that one-day race, was followed in the same part of France by the Tour des Alpes Maritimes, where day one belonged to Ethan Vernon of Israel Premier Tech, and day two, and indeed the general classification, to Benoît Cosnefroy of Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale. Aurélien Paris-Peintre was very instrumental in that victory for Cosnefroy, but so too was our own Larry Warbass, who of course featured on the podcast last week. Some flowers for Larry, chaps. He did a sterling job pulling on that last day. Again, we will talk more, I think, about that race a bit later on. Two stage races that have started but not yet finished. I will just also mention the UAE Tour, where Tim Malia won stage one, and the Tour of Rwanda, which we discussed in some detail last week, where Sudal Quickstep's development team won the opening stage team time trial, and Itamar Einhorn of Israel Premier Tech, a sprinter, took stage one. I was slightly confused by that because William Junior Lesurf, the climbing sensation, all 52 kilos of him, was second in that stage behind Itamar Einhorn. I'm not exactly sure how that played out, but it strikes me as bizarre that he would be sprinting. Chaps, I joked earlier on that we don't do track racing. Well, we will today, because last week we got the sad and very concerning news that six-time Olympic champion Sir Chris Hoy is being treated for cancer. Sir Chris said in a statement that he had wanted to keep the matter private, but that his hand had been forced. He added that the diagnosis happened last year. He's currently receiving treatment, including chemotherapy, but he is feeling fine, continuing to work, and looking forward to the Paris Olympics in July. Now, we don't usually talk about track racing, as already established, chaps, but Sir Chris is someone that I think we've all had some contact with over the years. I don't know him well. He was a very good friend and, well, colleague, because they worked together, of our late great founder, leader, Richard Moore. Richard was he collaborated with Chris on his autobiography, both born in Edinburgh, of course. And they were mutually very, very fond of each other. And of course, we wish Chris and his family all the very best over the coming weeks and months. Rob, you've worked with Chris as well on some track races.
Yeah, and Chris is actually one of the first people I exchanged message with once when we lost Richard the other year. And again, massively fond of Richard. Chris is one of those people, by the way, that they always say never meet your heroes. He's a big exception to the rule. He's a gentleman, an absolute lovely bloke. And again, wish him all the very best.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that as well. I think coming into the sport, it kind of in the middle of Chris's peak, I guess, like sort of between Beijing and London Olympics. Yeah, exactly that, Rob. Never meet your heroes. But Chris is one of those rare people who lives up to the hype almost in every way, I think, you know, as an athlete, but also as a person off the bike. So, yeah, wish him all the best.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, a VPN is a virtual private network to keep your data safe and secure when you're online, whether you're at home or on the move. And with the Spring Classic coming and then the Grand Tours and then the summer holiday season, maybe you're planning a trip overseas or just to another country if you're lucky enough to go to another country without having to cross the water. Either way, you might be planning to take your laptop or tablet, and you'll almost certainly be taking your phone and browsing the internet when you're away. And a VPN, NordVPN specifically, is the way to keep all of your data safe and secure when you're online and on the move. And the other reason to invest in NordVPN is that when you're on holiday or you're just in another country, you won't lose access to all of your favorite streaming services because you can just use NordVPN to select a server in your home country and you'll enjoy an uninterrupted access to your regular streaming services. So those are two of the key advantages for NordVPN. And if you are a Cycling Podcast listener, which obviously you are because you're listening to me now, go to nordvpn.com/TCP and you can get a great deal, a really big discount with NordVPN, an exclusive deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. It's also risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. There's also a link in the show notes, the episode description, so you can find that link really easily. But it's nordvpn.com/TCP. Now back to Daniel and the rest of the podcast.
Well, chaps, we've completed the news roundup. We've got some of the angst out of our system, out of my system this week. We sort of scratched the meme itch, the Omloop itch, that we'll return to talk about Omloop later in the episode. We're going to lock into review mode, though, in this second part, and we're going to focus particularly on the race that I think you were commentating on last week, Rob, the Volta ao Algarve. In the south of Portugal, of course. The result that everyone expected, Remco Evenepoel winning for the third time. He's won that race. He's become a real specialist in that race. Chaps, Remco now has 53 wins in his young career. I mentioned that because we did get a letter a couple of weeks ago. We talked about Marco Pantani. And, of course, last week, the 14th of February, it was the 20th anniversary of Marco Pantani's death. Now, sometimes we're guilty of assuming that everyone's been following the sport for as long as we have and that everyone is very familiar with riders' palmares. That's not always the case. And we did get a letter from a listener, Addy Nell, who... well, said that he would have liked to know more about Pantani's actual achievements. And just thinking about that number of Remco's, 53 wins. Now, Marco Pantani, who is a legend, one of the great legends of the sport, with whatever sort of caveats and asterisks you want to apply, but one of the great legends of Italian cycling, 26 wins in his career. So just under half Remco's win haul. Pantani, I will just recap for Addy, recap some of his most notable achievements. 8 Tour stage wins, 8 Giro stage wins. Of course, he won the Giro d'Italia in 1998. He won the Tour de France in 1998 as well. He was also third in the Tour de France twice and second in the Giro in 1994. So Pantani was very much someone who reserved his best performances for the biggest stages. Last week, I actually wrote a chapter for a collection of writing about Pantani in Italian, and I talked about the sort of disparity between Pantani's achievements and the size of his legacy and the adoration that he still inspires. And I sort of said, well, he maybe did 50 attacks that were televised live, and yet look at the size of his legacy. The Pogacars, the Remcos, there are others as well, they're winning at such a rate that our sort of perspective has been slightly skewed on how one builds a legacy and or the speed at which one can build a legacy. Anyway, that was a very long-winded intro, Rob, to you telling us about Remco's win in Portugal.
And just to finish off that intro, they race a lot less as well now. So the strike rate is absolutely ridiculous, isn't it, when you consider wins. Take Remco Evenepoel as an example to get onto what he did this week. There was a one-day race in Portugal last week, just the second edition, I think it was, of the Figueira Champions Classic, in a place called Figueira da Foz. Evenepoel took off with 55 kilometres to go in his first race of the season to get himself into his second half century. He raised his bat at the end of last season with 50 wins, 51 the other day, 52 in that time trial, his first win in the rainbow jersey as a time trialist, and taking it home with the general classification the other day. He's exceptional, isn't he? You know, I don't think there's too much point in us dwelling on that and saying that, because we've said that a lot already. But he's continuing to work. I mean, just an example of that, of his sort of continuing will to work. He went on holiday to Los Angeles at the end of last year with his wife. Whilst he was there, he could not stay off the bike, even though he had his longest break ever, 5 weeks completely off the bike. He was in the wind tunnel, testing with Specialized, testing with Castelli, working on the shoulder pads on his time trial suit. Obviously, he wasn't doing the stitching himself, was he? But you know what I mean. They were working, testing, and he just strives to continue to improve. And he's got these season goals, hasn't he? Liège, top five in the Tour, 2 medals from the Olympic Games and the World Championships, and he started very, very well. There is one remarkable thing about Remco, though. Do you know what? He's never ridden a stage race in France. And he's going to do it for the first time at Paris-Nice.
We mentioned this in the Vuelta last year, didn't we? That we thought that the stage going into France, the stage that was ultimately what led to his sort of demise in terms of the GC at the Vuelta, that was his first road race, excluding time trials. He's done the Chrono des Nations a couple of times. That was his first road race in France ever.
So, I mean, it's going to be interesting. He's if he competes all the scheduled races he's going to do in France this year, he's going to do 39 days. So it's a completely different calendar for him. Paris-Nice, Dauphiné, Tour de France, Olympic Games. Again, a lot can go wrong, but it started perfectly well. And in the Algarve that you mentioned, he has a 100% record now. He's turned up 3 times. He's won it 3 times. I think he's taken 4 stages between those different 3 races and those 3 overalls as well. He likes the Algarve, and not for his holidays.
Rob, what's the biggest positive from Remco's point of view? And maybe the biggest, I wouldn't say surprise, but given that we very much expected him to win, looking at the course, looking at the fact there was the time trial, as there always is, and you know they're not big climbs at this time of year either, was the biggest positive Mikel Landa's contribution? And I know that there was a moment on the last day when Wout van Aert and Ben Healy went down the road and Landa looked as though he was struggling. But broadly speaking, on the 2 days in the hills, Landa did make key contributions.
Massive contributions off the bike as well, apparently, if we believe everything that was said in and around the race. Landa was also playing road captain, bringing his experience, you know. We know that we've been talking about Landis more in the last few years and whether it's been working, more often than not working, but he's been sort of going down gallantly and heroically in the act of trying to win big things. But before, he's also played domestique in the earlier part of his career, and he's been in grand winning tour teams. He knows what to do.
I think we forget that. He was mainly a domestique.
Exactly, yeah.
The first part of his career. First for Fabio Aru in at Astana, and then of course for Chris Froome at Sky.
Whether he wanted to be domestic for that is another thing if we go back there, but he did it very well. But yeah, the days at Sky, and he knows what to do, and the talk is on that final stage. And if anybody wasn't watching, I think there were 39 kilometers remaining. We're on one of the categorized climbs, I think third to last climb, and Wout van Aert decided to take off. Ben Healy followed him. Wout van Aert was at 1 minute 18 in the general classification. Ben Healy at 1 minute 20. A lot of terrain still to go to pick up that time. 10 bonus seconds on the finish. So they needed a little bit more than a minute to steal the general classification on the final day. And there was a massive group of 20 strong riders up the road to bridge to. This was a serious move, but there was no panic. Lander got the troops organised, and it wasn't just Lander. Catania was up in the break and doing a great job. He dropped back. He's getting stronger by the year, by the way. Sort of a Benjamin Button character, I think. And then, you know, even people like Mr. Dependable Peter Siddy was just tapping away at the front. And they just did it so, so well. And Lander was pulling on the flat towards the end. Everybody hands to the pump, and in the end, it all got brought back together. Van Aert, brilliant for trying. Healy as well. Didn't come off, and, you know, a second place in the final sprint. He'll have been disappointed he didn't win. He said he was stuck in the big ring, but he won the overall, and I think that's a much better sign than what we've seen in the last few years, because that has been the problem, hasn't it? We know that Remco Evenepoel's a superstar, we know he's gifted, but it's always been, what about the team? Certainly this winter with, you know, all that happened with the fusion, not fusion, takeover, not takeover, all of that sort of stuff. The question was, oh, can they cobble a team together? Yep. The Tour de France is a different thing, isn't it? A completely different beast, but the early signs are pretty good.
I was quite surprised to hear when he went and recce'd the TT course, didn't he, Remco, quite a few times. He did it two or three laps of that course, which seems unusual for such an early season race, but you get the feeling that that what Quickstep are trying to do, as much as win races like the Tour of Algarve, but it's do a dry run for what it's going to take to go and attempt a grand tour and just kind of go through the process. I mean, I don't know, were there any other riders doing that sort of preparation?
Stefan Kung did, but that's a sort of special moment for him in the early season. I think every year he goes to the Algarve and he has a real go at that time trial. And in front of the time trial as well, laying down a marker seemed to be important for me, because if you looked at the cast list, that was probably the best time trial cast list outside the Olympic Games and World Championships this year, given the fact that people like Van Aert aren't going to the Tour de France.
It was technical as well, wasn't it? It was not an easy TT as well. Yeah.
Very.
I wonder about Remco with, you know, thinking about his perception, and you bring in the Pantani comparison, Daniel, but I almost feel there's been so much hype about Remco ever since he was a teenager that, it, you know, par for him is winning and succeeding, and anything other than that is almost seen as a letdown, as a failure. And I think until he's got the monkey off his back in the form of a performance, or maybe even he has to win the tour in order to kind of achieve the benchmark that's been set for him ever since he sort of came onto the scene as a cyclist. And I think that's the prism through which we sort of see Remco, and certainly they see him in Belgium. I get the feeling the Belgian press pick up on what he's done.
You still get hints of how that pressure is brought to bear on him. For example, on the final stage, he was out sprinted for the second time by Dani Martinez, and he made this comment about, well, how he couldn't get his chain in the small chain ring, and he sort of suggested that he would have won. And I've seen a lot of people sort of jump on this, maybe take it out of context a little bit, suggest that he was being he wasn't being very magnanimous, and that really what he should have been saying was great ride by Dani Martinez, round of applause. But there is sometimes the sense that these moments of, I'm not going to call it petulance, but these moments of sort of angst, their root is to be found in the pressure that he's under, particularly from the Belgian media. Rob, you mentioned the time trial. There was a fair bit of experimentation that went on there. I think Wout van Aert was experimenting with a new position. I saw some pictures, some annotated pictures of riders' chest fairing, basically stuff they'd stuck up their skin suit to make them more aerodynamic. I don't know what they've been sticking up their skin suits.
There was actually a warning about that in the race communique, because the UCI getting hotter on it, and there was a warning about, the thing is, it didn't specify any limits, but there was a big red marker the night before saying, well, you know that this isn't particularly allowed. So I think that they were probably trying to get it into riders' heads that at certain points this year, there will be checking.
Is it allowed?
Only to a certain extent. You're not exactly allowed to, you know, put a full prosthesis down there and make it much more aero and things like that.
So we're not talking copies of La Gazzetta dello Sport, which
no,
of course
we're not.
Riders
no, we're
often
not.
Used to stick
it's not
down
the top
there,
of the Stelvio.
Down their front at the top of climbs. I wonder if our younger listeners even know or realise that. That was a very, very common thing up until a few years
back
ago.
Back in my day.
Maybe you're allowed to stick a single copy of La Gazzetta dello Sport, but not sort of the Saturday supplement. That would be too much fairing. There were some interesting time trial performances, weren't there, Rob? A lot of people were struck by, for example, Isaac del Toro, who we talked about a few weeks ago, the young Mexican rider who, of course, won a stage at the Tour Down Under. Him beating, in inverted commas, Filippo Ganna and Wout van Aert.
Well, Ganna wasn't impressed with his own ride, so I think that's fair to state that, just to give Ganna a little bit of a defence. He said he wasn't impressed with his form, but he had a bit of an illness. He had to stop for a little while during the winter, and I think he's sort of playing catch-up. But his objectives are much further down the line and probably more on the track this year in the Olympic Games. Sorry, I know I wasn't meant to mention the T word. UAE Emirates against the likes of Ganna, and that's the headline, isn't it? And that's what we said in the broadcast as well. You know, you're looking for that headline. Wow, first professional time trial and he beats Ganna. My big question mark over him this week, we've already seen what he did down under on the climbs and in Figueira da Foz as well, where he was impressive last week on the climbs. But it was our first opportunity to see both Del Toro and young Morgado, Portuguese, very, very gifted young rider in the TTs. Morgado had a really good record in the under-23s in the time trials, but Del Toro, he just didn't do too many. It was an uphill one in Tour de l'Avenir, so you're always thinking, well, it's a different beast, that's a different animal, different competition. But to turn up and finish in the top five, beat Filippo Ganna, I think this guy's the real deal, isn't he? And he was already at the GC, so he wasn't in the shake-up to compete with Remco Evenepoel, but I think, regardless of that, that will be big news this week for UAE Emirates, won't it?
I think it will, Rob. And you mentioned Morgado there, the Portuguese rider. We've seen over the last few years a few very talented young Portuguese riders emerge, the main one, of course, being João Almeida. And we often forget about, well, what a strong culture there is of cycling in Portugal. There were years, you know, I don't know, I think this was well reported, well documented at the time, but at the Tour de France, there used to be a competition, or it was somehow recorded, which rider got the most fan mail on the Tour de France. I don't know how you sent fan mail. I don't know whether you addressed a sort of an envelope to Christian Prudhomme saying, please pass to this rider or the other rider. However, Rui Costa used to win this by an absolute landslide every year. I think this was the meme of the sort of noughties or the last 10 years in the Tour de France, that you would send fan mail to Rui Costa. And this got me thinking, chaps, just thinking about Morgado and thinking about him making his debut in the Volta. I think he's making his debut in the Volta Algarve, certainly as a professional UAE. Volta ao Algarve, one of two big stage races really in Portugal, the other one being the Volta a Portugal. This year it was the 40th anniversary of something tragic happening at the Volta Algarve. That was the most famous, most successful Portuguese rider of all time, Joaquim Agostinho, unfortunately, tragically dying at the 84 Volta ao Algarve. He was riding his swan song season with Sporting Club de Portugal and Sporting Lisbon, most people know them as in football. He took the yellow jersey on stage four, but 350 metres from the finish line of stage five, he hit a stray dog. Now, the footage of this is online. You can find it. I'll post it actually on social media, on X, once this episode goes up, and you can watch it. He asks his teammate to help him up. He makes it to the finish line. He then made it back to the team hotel, but started vomiting at the team hotel. whereupon the team took him to the Lule hospital, the closest hospital, only to find the x-ray machine wasn't working there. He was then taken to Faro hospital, where they discovered there was no neurology department and there was no helicopter available, so he had to be driven to Lisbon, which is about 7 or 8 hours away, I think, and he fell into a coma on his way, and he died 10 days later. And well, again, the footage is online. If you see pictures from his funeral, it was a state funeral, and it was a 70 kilometer procession from Lisbon to Silveira, his birthplace, about 70 kilometers away on the coast, and you can't even see the road surface. There are so many people on the road in the cortege. And Agostinho, well, he was a fascinating character, chaps. He was sort of a Peter Sagan meets Thibaut Pinot meets Lenny from Mice and Men, just this supernaturally strong sort of brutish rider. He looked at times on the bike, and he'd been discovered. He fought for 3 years with the Portuguese army in Angola and Mozambique during the Portuguese colonial war, and his captain during the war in Mozambique discovered him. He was a bicycle messenger, and he used to carry these messages on a very heavy bike, and it was taking him 2 hours to ride 50 kilometers while it was taking his fellow officers five. He then went to ride a criterium in Brazil once he'd sort of been discovered, and there one a legendary French direct sportif called Jean de Cribaldi discovered him again and offered him the chance to sort of pursue a professional career in Europe. And again, this sort of brutish strength, when he started racing in Europe, immediately started winning. Eddie Merckx once said that he was the only rider that really worried him. He was a rider who hadn't, obviously, he hadn't sort of gone through the ranks and absorbed a lot of the sort of dogmas about how to race, how he would do unexpected things. Again, prodigiously powerful. He won 4 stages of the Tour de France. He was third overall twice. He finished in the top 10 at the Tour de France 8 times. Perhaps most notably, though, chaps, and this is not a particularly well-known story, but he was second in the Vuelta in 1974, and he finished just 11 seconds behind José Manuel Fuente. That Vuelta a España, I think, started on the 23rd of April 1974. The Estado Novo dictatorship, a 40-year dictatorship in Portugal, it would finish 2 days into that Vuelta. What they call the Carnation Revolution. Yeah. Revolution was taking place in Portugal. So midway through, or at the start of that Vuelta, Portugal became a democracy again for the first time in 40 years. And Agostinho, well, he was riding fantastically well. And he went into the last stage, a time trial, starting in San Sebastian and finishing in San Sebastian, 35 kilometers, with a genuine chance of winning the Vuelta a España. When José Manuel Fuente crossed the line, it looked as though Agostinho had taken the race lead and taken the Vuelta. And in fact, commentators at the time said Agostinho has won the Vuelta. However, shortly thereafter, the result was corrected, adjusted. They said they'd got the timings wrong by about 15 seconds or so, and that Fuentes was in fact the winner of that Vuelta. Now, there are all sorts of conspiracy theories about this, because you know the dictatorship in Spain was still in place, and it would be in place for another year, and it was said that the Spanish didn't want a Portuguese rider winning because they didn't like the idea of someone who had come from a country where this revolution had taken place to win. Another conspiracy theory has it that it wasn't in the last stage where Agostinho was cheated. He was robbed. There were sort of seconds added to his time throughout the race, a second here, a second there. But I know there are numerous journalists in Portugal who have tried to go back and locate the actual footage, do their own timings of that time trial in San Sebastian to establish the truth, and have been sort of unsuccessful or inconclusive in that. But it strikes me that this should be the subject of a detailed investigation. As I said, Joaquim Agostinho, 40 years since his death in the Volta a Algarve. In the year 2000, chaps, he was voted the fourth most important Portuguese sports person of the 20th century, behind Eusebio, Carlos Lopez, and Rosa Mota, the marathon runner.
Wow, that's incredible. And just to link to, you were talking about Pantani right at the start. Every year in the Algarve, we see these sort of placards and signs everywhere Agostini, and they were there on the final stage again on Sunday, which takes place not too far from Lule, the scene of that tragic arrival at the hospital.
A real character, certainly in the 70s, chaps. And this got us thinking, didn't it? Well, first of all, there's a link here with Theo Gegenhardt and his comeback to racing at the Volta al Algarve. And Rob, just quickly tell us how he got on.
Very, very well, in fact. He was climbing with the best on the first mountain stage and he was up there with the very best on the final mountain stage. And of course, he's had to work harder than probably most of us will ever realise, away from the gaze, the fans, the experts. We've seen the odd Insta post, haven't we? But he looked like he'd never been off the bike when he was climbing. The only issue was probably the time trial. To be honest, he may well have gone to the race knowing that his time trial wasn't up to scratch, because I imagine, again, no sports scientist or biomechanics expert here, but I imagine that's something that gets to work on once you're back in the bunch, and you know that requires separate work, doesn't it?
I said that, well, there's a link with Agostinho, there's a link with great characters of the sport, Richard, because, well, Theo was, well, he was posting on Instagram quite prolifically throughout the week in Portugal, and prolifically and interestingly, very thoughtfully. And there was one post in particular that caught a lot of people's eye, and it caught your eye as well, Richard, didn't it? Just about personality and riders, really sort of communicating and conveying their personality to the watching public.
I think it caught my eye because this point in the season is a strange mix of all this stuff happening that's kind of important, but kind of doesn't matter until on loop day, basically, or at the start of the season proper. There's this sort of undercurrent, this background of the one cycling, the Saudi back reform and or game changer for cycling and what that might look like. And it's sort of been listening to what's happening in the wider world about like streaming platforms like Netflix getting much more interested in sport and live sport, and the success of Drive to Survive and what impact that's had on Formula One and so on. And so what Theo was saying was that the sport, in his opinion, was missing the sort of characters that it used to have. And it kind of got me thinking that in a way was, I'd maybe failed to find perhaps in these early season races, is the sort of characters that we might be looking for. Almost like a sort of soap opera would be the wrong word, but you know, that's ultimately what people are looking for, is sort of storytelling, isn't it? And a narrative and characters that are quite, they have those emotions and those storylines. They wear them so obviously, and people can identify with them quite easily through the medium that they engage with. And I'm not sure cycling is doing a terrific job at that at the moment. I sort of found myself slightly agreeing with Theo, whether that's because, you know, cyclists are now hid behind helmets and glasses. I mean, that's not a new thing, but that's been remarked upon before, hasn't it? Sort of over the last, compare it to like the Merckx era or Agostinho era, for example. You know, you could see who it was and people were very distinctive. And I don't know what your take is on this, Rob, but I find it increasingly hard to spot the difference between riders, and certainly from helicopter shots. That's just, you know, kind of a fact of what cycling is to watch now. What made me think about it was watching the Tour des Alpes Maritimes. The first stage of that, there was a rider out in the breakaway and he clung on till about, I don't know, well, he almost got caught with sort of 5k to go, and then he went out again, and the collective might of, you know, the strong teams in that race, like well, Larry Warbass,
I mean, Larry's unmistakable.
They couldn't bring him back, but he had, well, I described it to you earlier as like a 1990s Pantene advert hair, perfectly set.
I've got his picture in front of me. He looks magnificent. He's beautiful, brunette mane, sort of chestnut mane.
And you see him and you think, okay, well, he's doing this thing on the bike that, okay, is eye-catching, but it's not unique. It's not standout. But what makes him stand out is he's got this instantly distinctive hairstyle. That's all it is. But I immediately found myself sort of identifying with him and wanting him to do well. And I looked him up on Instagram, and then you find out a bit more about him and a bit more about his character. And he's got a dog, and he has this, what looks like an amazing life in south of France. So, you know, he's a local boy. His hero is René Vietto, who's, you know, sort of a character. We don't have to delve into the whole history, but, you know, someone who's these myths and legends are written and retold about Vietto and his toes in formaldehyde in a bar in Marseille, is that right, or something like that. You know, French TV made a documentary about René Vietto in a few years ago, and they called him the King of Melancholy or something. I think it was the title, the Roi Melancholique. And you know, that's, I don't know whether we're going to be making documentaries about the current crop of cyclists, calling them King of Melancholy. I don't know, and I'm not sure how you change it. It's not that you can just ask riders to be more characterful or show more character, but there's got to be some way, if we are going to change how the sport is run or how it operates, like, just bring a bit more of that back, I think would probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, the point on, well, the sort of ironically, the point was made by Theo on social media as well, but I'm not sure. I think we all know that social media is really powerful, and the riders and sports people and famous people can leverage their image. I don't always think we've all figured out, or they've all figured out, how exactly to do that. And Theo's post last week were a good example of a way in which he's sort of offering a keyhole view into his sort of psyche, into his thoughts, into his personality. And I've had a conversation with Theo about the contrast as well between sort of more fringe left field worlds, like, for example, a sort of discipline sport that I'm very interested in, mountain running, trail running, and these kind of riders who are, these protagonists who are real one-man bands, don't have teams, they don't have any kind of apparatus around them, besides perhaps a sponsor that gives them some trainers and asks them to, you know, maybe do a post every now and again. Teo and I have talked about, yeah, he's got some good friends in that world. There's a Swiss trail runner called Rémi Bonnet. Teo's talked about how much more relatable that world is, maybe also because often these trail runners and so on, they're competing in events that Joe Public can enter. They're competing in sort of glorified kind of grand fondos of that world. But also, you know, there are other factors. Richard, as you said, they're not wearing helmets. And it all just does seem a little bit more off the cuff and impromptu. But it's an interesting topic. Rob, I'm sure you've got some thoughts.
Yeah, and I don't really want to bring everybody crashing down to reality, but unfortunately, I am going to do it.
We're in a bad mood anyway.
Well, I am going to do it. It's just, I mean, and again, I'm part of the camp here that does want what Theo is asking for, but realistically, how easy is it to provide? I'm not sure, because it's a professional sport and an ever increasingly professional sport. You know, we can all go back and talk to parents and grandparents, and you know, back in the day, footballer used to go down the pub and have a pint after the match. The same thing's happened in football. You know, the biggest sport of them all, it's become professional. They've become a part. They're told to say certain things, not to say certain things. When you're working for a sponsor and a team that is professional, of course, they're going to be very, very, not controlling, but they're going to have an interest in what you say on social media, because you have to be on brand. I guess it's just an unfortunate product of the sport becoming more professional.
I mean, look at the point we made a few minutes ago, or we didn't quite go there, but we could have gone there, about Remco and his comments about Dani Martinez. Now, I think this is one thing that we can be pretty sure about, and we've all seen, and we can track and trace how in the last 10 years in social media, with social media, riders, sports people, famous people have become more and more cautious and circumspect, because they've all had their hands burned, and they have been wise to do so, and they have learned from painful experience. We have all probably as well learned from painful experiences, but it is kind of, even that has been at the cost of aspects of their personality that we'd no longer get to see. I mean, even if you go back 10 years, and this has become very, very rare, there were certain riders out there who, over a short period of time, developed a bit of a reputation as firebrands, as sort of volatile characters, because they tweeted this or tweeted that. And that's kind of, it's kind of disappeared. So that's another sort of forum in which, another platform, sort of literally and figuratively, on which we can see aspects of their of their character that's kind of been taken away. So what we get now is just a very sterilized version. It's sterilized on the images that, you know, Eurosport broadcasts Rob and all the other broadcasters show us. That's sort of a 2D picture of racing with, you know, beautiful landscape and what and so on and so forth, and the interviews that I do after the finish and so on and so forth. And it's also in the bits that happen away from the race, it's also a bit sterile, because again, you know, no one wants that kind of angst and negativity in their life that comes with exposing yourself.
I think it's kind of the media's fault in a way for that, because it's increasingly rare.
Agreed.
And so, you know, you sort of give the press, I use that term quite loosely, I mean, not all press are the same, but you give them an inch and they'll take a yard. And so quite often when a rider does show any glimpse of character there, then, you know, the media will interpret that in a way and cling on to that. And that becomes a characterization and almost a caricature of a rider. And actually the truth is a lot more nuanced and also subject to change. And I think that's been in the past, you know, you speak to some riders off the record and about that, or maybe about sometimes their backstory, or maybe an incident that's happened, or just something they've said, and that becomes a bit of a stick to beat them with, that they sort of worry about exposing too much of themselves because it will become their label. And I think that's definitely happened, but it's sort of self-fulfilling, because the less of it there is, the more the media is going to latch onto anything, any crumb that's there.
You're absolutely right. And this is where the kind of clickbait media attention economy is so damaging. And it winds me up, actually, when, you know, and sometimes our colleagues, or sometimes we're guilty of willingly ignoring the context. They know. And for example, last week, this was a sort of an innocuous example, but I mentioned, and we sort of joked about it, the comments from Eusebio Unzué about substitutes in Grand Tours. And I sort of explained what I thought probably the context was. I thought he was just sort of sitting down with some friendly journalists and kind of spinning his wheels and kind of just, you know, off the top of his head, suggesting things. And of course, this then feeds, fuels clickbait headlines, mockery, and possibly, I think Eusebio is old enough and experienced enough to not really care too much, but in the case of younger individuals, riders, that then makes them think twice about even engaging with the media in future, because what have you got to gain from it?
And we're seeing that in a lot of post-race interviews as well. We get some pretty, pretty drab interviews. And again, this is not an overt, direct criticism always of the riders, because it's never an easy time to talk. No, it's never an easy time to talk, is it? When, you know, when you've been doing silly numbers of watts for 3, 4, 5 hours and then you have a microphone. But again, unfortunately, it's part of their job. If you want to be, that's another thing that riders also have to understand, I guess. But, you know, there has to be a chat maybe where those microphones and those riders can meet each other halfway, and maybe a bit of the window can be opened ever so slightly. But it's a difficult thing to ask for both broadcasters who want more, and of course, you know, bosses who are going to want people to focus on those nasty clickbait things. And the riders who, for obvious reasons, don't want to give too much away. It is a very difficult situation to move on into any different, more positive territory, isn't it? But fair play to Fatale for putting out his own thoughts and at least starting this conversation.
Well, chaps, we've spoken about what has gone before, what happened last week. Now, time to tell the world that there are only 4 days until Omloop, and it will soon be Happy Omloop Day.
How are you going to celebrate, Daniel?
And probably I turned disconnecting the internet on that for a few hours that morning. Less I get riled. It is opening weekend. It is exciting. It is an exciting weekend. It's a context switch, isn't it? It's a complete sort of, it's like being teleported back in time or into the future, completely different landscapes from everything we've seen so far in the season. different cast of characters to an extent, because this is another thing that's curious about this weekend. We've seen a few riders who are going to be at the forefront of affairs at the weekend, but in quite different contexts. You know, I think of Jan Tratnik, for example, who's been one of the strongest riders of this early season. And Jan Tratnik anyway is a difficult rider to pigeonhole, because sometimes, you know, you'll see him pulling for 100 kilometers up climbs, but then you get to this time of the year and you expect him to be contending in races like Omloop. But there are a few riders like that. Stefan Kung always goes well in the Algarve, and he becomes a sort of a climber for a couple of days on those fairly innocuous climbs in the Algarve. But then at the weekend, we will see him in Omloop, and then we will not see some riders who we would maybe expect to see, like Sir Mathieu van der Poel and Mads Pedersen and so on. Before we talk about Omloop, or this year's Omloop, we should remind the listeners of what happened last year. Last year, it was a victory for the rider that I refer to as the Diamond Thief. Generally, well, for his manner of winning these big classics, sort of goes away by stealth. I think I've talked on the podcast before about how your Italian colleague, Rob, Italian Eurosport, Riccardo Magrini, calls this the Fagianata. He goes away like a pheasant, sort of scurrying off on the side of the road, and then kind of takes off without anyone really noticing. And that's what he's an expert in. Last year, he got away in a couple of phases, really, with about 38 kilometers to go. He was in a four-man group. Then he was left with Mathis Lebel from Arkea, just the two of them, who he then dropped on the Mur van Heraldsbergen, which, of course, now features on the Omloop route. And he then won the race pretty comfortably. And it was the start of a dominant classics period, to a certain extent, for what was then Jumbo-Visma, although they didn't bring home the big prizes. Chaps, they have got an extraordinarily strong team at the weekend. Dylan van Baarle, defending champion, Wout van Aert, Christophe Laporte, Thijs Benoot, who won Koerner-Brussels-Koerner last year. Koerner, of course, comes the day after Omloop. Tratnik, who we've mentioned. Matteo Jorgensen, who's making his debut for...
Yeah.
Visma Lisa bike, and again he's one of those riders who sort of challenges our preconceptions, in the sense that he's a good climber, he can win hilly stage races, but he's also got a lot of potential in the classics. And then I suppose the one domestique, but what a domestique he is, that they will have is Eduardo Affini. I'll just mention a few other names on the start list: Tom Pidcock for Ineos, Tim Wellens, Arnaud Delis, who was second last year, Oyer Lazcano from Movistar, who's a bit of a hipster outsider's tip, Biniam Gamay, Kasper Asgreen, Stefan Kung, Jonathan Milan, Jasper Stuyven, Ben Turner for Ineos, Alberto Bettiol, Julien Alaphilippe, Jasper Philipsen, Matej Mohoric, Ivan Cortina, Matteo Trentin, Alexander Kristoff, Florian Senechal, Gianni Moscon, and Fred Wright, who we're going to hear from in a short while. But Rob, you'll be on duty. It is a mouth-watering prospect.
It is. I'll be working for the host broadcaster this weekend. So I think if you're listening in the United States, you might hear me. And you'll be stuck with me all day. I'm on my own this weekend. So apologies in advance to all you United States listeners. Yeah, it's a changing world, isn't it? A changing sport. But this is that comforting, familiar feeling. The arrival of the Flemish Spring. And of course, openings weekend, as they call it over there. All those names that become familiar again this time, the Haarhoek, the Leeberg. There's no more Langemunter, which I miss in this race. I did used to like when it was a real Omloop and it went back to Ghent. But, you know, the organisers, Flanders Classics, you're not going to hear me criticising what they've done with these races, because they've kept them alive. They are thriving. They're interesting parkour. And of course, with not having the Mur in the Ronde of Vlaanderen anymore, we keep that Mur and Bosberg combination alive in a different guise here. So it'll be great racing. You've reeled off the names, and you know, by the time we're going up the Mur and all the crowds are there, you know, the chapel comes out of his, so the priest comes out of the little chapel to have the best seat in the house. The bells will be ringing, and you know, even Lionel will be saying, "We've started now."
Well, the race was first founded in, well, it was founded in 1945. And this extraordinary statistical quirk persists, survives, that no rider has ever won Omloop, and also that the Ronde van Vlaanderen and the Tour of Flanders, which, you know, I'm not sure there are many...
In the same year, we should say,
In the same year. I'm not sure. A lot of these curses, purported, reported curses in cycling have been sort of debunked now. The curse of the rainbow jersey doesn't really stand up. There are smaller ones, less well-known ones, like the curse of the GP La Marseillaise in France. Whoever wins La Marseillaise is going to have a rotten season. That's kind of quite a newfangled one as well, which was sort of talked up for a few years. But this one, I would put it to you that it might actually be a curse, because there's something in the history of the races as well. The Omloop was actually set up, it was founded as a to sort of rival the Ronde van Vlaanderen by a rival newspaper. Ironically, it's now called Het Nieuwsblad. Het Nieuwsblad used to run the Ronde van Vlaanderen, and Omloop was set up by Het Volk, which is another newspaper in Flanders. Chaps, I think I've described it before as well. I've drawn the parallel between this and the Masters, the US Masters, the Par 3 tournament, which takes place the day before the US Masters in golf. Never been won by the same player, and Omloop has never yielded the victor of that year's Tour of Flanders. Why? Why?
Timing? You've got to be good from end of February to the end of March. However, you know, and there's crashes, there's injuries, there's illness. It's that time of year. But again, if something's there to be broken in these days of less racing, more of targeted focus racing, maybe this is something that can be achieved. The bullseye can be hit finally by somebody like a Wout van Aert, maybe, in the coming years with a different build-up.
What everybody said at the time, and I think what's sort of happened in the last 10 years since they changed the Tour of Flanders, is that that's become more of a sort of strongman contest or an arm wrestle. So it's less tactically nuanced than it used to be. There's always an out-and-out favourite or a handful of favourites that are going to be the riders that are going to win it. Whereas Het Nieuwsblad's got that sort of... It's a bit shorter. They've got the old Flanders finish. It pretty much identical, isn't it, basically? Yeah. That last sort of 16-15k or so. Because it's the first big classic of the season, everybody's a bit like, well, it matters, but it's not the be-all and end-all. So there's less fear of losing, I think, in the teams. I mean, obviously there's the usual post-mortem, isn't there, like the sort of annual how did Quickstep do, or how did such and such rider do, and the Belgian press all sort of get stuck in there. But it tends to be raced with a bit more freedom and a bit more willingness to lose, I think. A bit more, perhaps, like audacity in the riders. So I think, to go back to your curse, Daniel, it is surely, to echo what Rob said, it's timing, isn't it? I think if you're going to peak in April, or it's first weekend in April, can you be going well now at the end of February? Have you got time to hold that form, or like drop off and come back again? Or
I think it's genuine magic. I think it's a genuine hex that will never be broken. That's what I would like to think. We'll still be here podcasting in 100 years talking about how this has never been broken and it's unbreachable. I think you're right. How many weeks is it until Flanders? Is it about six? No, not as many as that. Five or six. It's a long time. But in terms of, look, there are riders who'll be very strong this weekend who will be strong at Flanders. And we've seen that in the past. There are examples of riders who have gone very close in one or the other. So it can be done. It can be done, but it won't be done. Any tips, chaps?
In terms of who's going to win?
Yeah, in terms of who's going to think. I mean, I think the race will be, Jumbo will Visma, Lisa Bike will just... They will try to suffocate every move. They will try to obviously put a man with every move until we get to the sort of the phase of the race where last year Van Baarle made his decisive move. You know, you could always get a situation where the anointed Visma Lisa bike rider for that particular move is not as fast a sprinter as, for example, Arnaud Delis, and finds himself being beaten in a sprint. That could happen. But I do think there will certainly be a Jumbo Visma Lisa bike rider in the finale, in the group that wins the race.
Will it be a group? We'll see. You know, what will the final selection look like? I tell you what, Lotto Destiny will be hoping that Arnaud Delis in it again. He was second last year. Do you know what? For a big Belgian team, talking about runs and hexes and curses, they have not won the Omloop Nieuwsblad since 2002. 22 years for Lotto Destiny without winning that race, I would say, is an absolutely enormous amount of time. Peter von Peterkin was the last winner.
Well, he's not going to win it, is he?
He's not going to win it this time, no. They've had a blow this year with Vermeers being out for the spring after that very nasty crash, but all eyes will be on Arnaud Delis as he lines up for them.
This time last year, of course, the hype around Arnaud Delis was reaching fever pitch because he'd won pretty much everything that he'd wanted to win for the previous 6 months. And I remember this time last year, I was sort of tipping him for Milan-San Remo. The hype kind of got a cold shower at, I was at Paris-Nice last year, and he struggled a bit more there. And that was sort of the pattern in the bigger races for the rest of the year. I mean, at Omloop last year, he did impress a lot of people because he crashed at a key moment. Yet despite that, was still sort of dropping everyone, pretty much everyone on the Mur, and then finishing second. So he will certainly be, well, he'll be one of the riders to watch at the weekend. Chap, should we hear from another rider who has certainly got a chance at the weekend? Bahrain Victorious is Fred Wright. He has ridden Omloop before, has had his best results in Belgium in the classics, in Tour of Flanders, in the Ronde van Vlaanderen, eighth last year, seventh the year before that. He is the British road race champion, Fred Wright, and I spoke to him today about Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and, well, just what kind of preparation he's had for opening weekend.
Sort of fondest, not fondest, but got a strong memory of the first one I did, and just like getting to the finish and being like, wow, it was my second race, like proper race as a pro with the team. 2020, we're talking, pre-COVID, pre-everything like that kicking off. And it was kind of, I'd gone to the Saudi tour and helped my teammate sort of win and stuff. And it was like, oh, wow, this, being a pro, this is
easy.
This is all good. And then straight to Belgium, sort of Nieuwsblad. It was windy, really windy that day. We had like splits, groups all over the place before we'd even hit the Paddestrat, which, you know, doing the recon again today seems mad. It was basically just an absolute brute of a day on the bike. Just getting to the finish felt like an achievement, that first one, and I was really like, wow, this is proper bike racing. This is what it's all about. And I mean, I loved it, but it also was, I was like, wow, this is horrible at the same time. You know, year on year, you come here, you do recon, you know, now I've rode around the road today, and it's, I can tell you which is the next climb, what's the next corner like, oh, this happened on this corner. You pick it all up so quickly, the more you do it. And I really kind of, I know it now. I mean, it's like almost racing on, well, not racing on home roads, but it's racing on roads that you'd know really well, as if they're like your local training roads. And it's such a nice feeling, you know, when you ride on them. Like, it kind of, it's mad that you can be, you know, not the most beautiful looking areas, but I kind of ride around the roads today just with a smile on my face, like, oh, we got the Mur coming up, oh, we're going down the Hardcook or whatever. So
with some nostalgia, nice. You even know the names now. There are some riders get to the point where they know where they are, but they still are a bit sketchy as far as the names are concerned. So is that the first time this year when you've gone where you've really felt you know it inside out?
I think so, yeah. I guess always at school I was, you know, I wasn't that great at writing, you know, writing pieces or writing things down, but I'd always remember silly facts, and like, I didn't find revising that difficult because, I don't know, I'd remember, you know, stupid facts from history or whatever. And I think that maybe plays into my hands a little bit when it comes to learning these roads, because now I've got this, a good sort of recollection of, I tell you what, there's a section in I think it's in Kerner, where you go over three climbs in a row that all begin with a K, and I can't which the order is of those ones, though. Kluisberg, the Nocturberg, the Kruisberg.
If you don't know which one it is, it's always the Kruisberg in one of those races. It's always the Kruisberg. Fred, you've walked right into this, because I was going to ask you to talk us through the climbs in the last 50 kilometers, but I'm going to turn it into a bit of a quiz now. So what comes up for Molenberg?
Molenberg, then you a little bit crosser maybe on the top, and you come down, and then you go up, bit of a drag left, down the Harkrug again for the third time, Leyburg, and then Berendries after that.
And then three more climbs after that?
The next one after Berendries, I don't know.
Elverenberg, Vossenhall.
This one's just like suffer, you'll be all right kind of climb. And then it's the Mur, and then it's the Bosberg.
And then it's the Bosberg, yeah.
The finish.
Well, give us a rider's eye view of those phases of the race. You've already talked about the sort of wind on top of the Molenberg. Talk us in from that point, sort of 40, 50 kilometres to go. What will you be looking to do on Saturday? What will you be hoping is happening in the race?
Well, really, it kind of all sets up like 70k to go. Like a lot of, we'll use up a few of our, you know, the more like helper riders getting into the right turn that basically everyone knows about, and that really sets you up for that sort of second to last phase of the race where you've got the Wolfenberg and most importantly the Molenberg. And that's where, yeah, Molenberg is kind of where the first like big boy attacks can happen. The strong guys can play their cards, and yeah, basically for me it's being there. Maybe not, I'm not necessarily making moves at that point, but you want to be in the race at that point. And you know, you've seen it in years past where breaks have gone at that point, and then you do the Berendries, also attacks can go there. You have this sort of slight settling down period before you hit the Mur and the Bosberg, where there might be a group up the road, or there's one bigger group, and then in the final is the Mur and the Bosberg, and that's where hopefully you've saved your legs from, you've got something left in the tank to smash it and fight with the best guys.
Obviously, everyone knows this quirky statistic, the fact that no one has won Omloop and Tour of Flanders in the same year. And it's baffling in some respects and maybe not in others, because there's a big difference in the distances of the two races. And obviously, the Omloop comes 6 weeks or so earlier. Is it surprising to you that the same rider hasn't won both in the same year? Or does the explanation lie in basically what I've just said, that it is a bit too early to be at your best, and also it will probably suit a different kind of rider because it's so much shorter?
It's a combination of a lot of things. You'll definitely see the people that make big moves and can get away around that time of the Molenberg, Berendries. Those are you'll see the guys that do that are definitely going to be the guys fighting for the win potentially in Flanders. But then how the race then develops after that is yeah, like you said, it's not quite long enough to put that real fatigue in the legs, and you often get slightly different combinations of riders, I guess, that have maybe come into form a little bit earlier, or even the best guys, they sort of, it's almost like they're testing their legs, but they're not necessarily showing their kind of best form just yet. So it's an interesting one. It really it's one of my favourite ones, actually, the way the race pans out. It's always really interesting. To be honest, the Mur and the Bosberg are that's like the Wombo combo.
The Wombo combo? What does that mean?
I feel like, I don't know, it's just iconic, isn't it?
The OG combo. Yeah, it's interesting you say that. It's interesting you say that, because you're young enough to have grown up watching the current circuit predominantly, yeah. I would say. Is that right?
I've still got in my head like that the Cancellara and Boonen, and Cancellara just absolutely leaving Boonen in the dust on the Mur. I've got that kind of in my mind when I think about it.
The Wombo combo, wow. Fred, you said that you enjoy Omloop. However, results suggest that the Tour of Flanders itself suits you better, and the extra fatigue and the extra length suits you better.
I would say so. I think the past couple of years of doing this race, I've been like, oh yeah, I feel good. And then, you know, made a couple of errors here and there, or like 2 years ago, I was working for Sony to try and... I think I was Van Aert attacked, and I was just desperately trying to bringing back. I mean, I wasn't, the gap wasn't closing, it was going out, but we still, I think Sony managed to get second that day, so that was still, that was quite a good one. But yeah, results wise, I'm hoping for a bit more on Saturday, but again, if it doesn't come, it's kind of a, it's a no panic sort of thing. It's, yeah, see what the legs are saying. You know, how the past few weeks have been, and how I was feeling today as well, I think should be good. I'm excited for Saturday, that's for sure.
It's not your season debut. You rode in Saudi Arabia as well on the Lula Tour. But Fred, we haven't spoken to you all winter. Just give us a quick summary of how you think the winter went and where you spent it and whether you did anything different this winter compared to other years.
I guess learning a bit from past mistakes and putting in different sort of phases of training, like almost rearranging them. So I'm sort of, okay, it meant I wasn't necessarily flying in Saudi, but I think it's what we've done is put me in good stead for sort of built, like almost hitting the classics flying rather than flying and then holding on to it, if that makes sense. I think we've kind of done quite a bit of work in the gym as well. And like I said, I've just been back from a training camp in Gran Canaria, so I've really kind of invested in trying to shape myself as best as possible.
So attitude.
I've known what works in the years before, but I think I feel like I've done a good job this year of really ticking all the boxes. No bad luck and things like that, and just all set.
In Gran Canaria, you've been at altitude, I presume.
We didn't go for the altitude option yet. That was still something we thought about, but then again, it's like you were saying, it's still quite, 6 weeks or whatever till Flanders-Roubaix time. You don't necessarily have those, you get the train, you'll still have the training effect from that camp then, but not necessarily the actual benefits of the altitude itself. So I think we kind of went for the more, let's do a solid quality training camp where there isn't the altitude factor to add the fatigue in the legs, where I can really smash it. And then, put myself in a good stead for the season. And then if that doesn't work, then next year I will be at altitude. But I think you collect so much data from seasons of training. It's already, we've got graphs comparing of different things, whether it's weight or your power numbers and all that sort of stuff. So it's great. I can really kind of really try to perfect things up until this point. So
or just overthink.
Good. I feel like I'm not, if things don't go well, then I'll feel like I'm banging my head against the wall a little bit. But I think I've got faith. I've got faith in what we've built.
Well, if the engine is built, Fred, then what happens after Om Loop? How do you try to sort of hold on to the condition or just sort of hone the condition over the next few weeks? What's the program after this weekend?
Like I said, I kind of deliberately sort of moved the phases around a little bit. So it means that Paris-Nice hope is, because it's obviously Paris-Nice is next and it's such a hard, big lot of load. That is the kind of final bit of getting the form, rather than just it being an absolute load of fatigue. I'm hoping that increases my level rather than decreases it. So Paris-Nice next, and then San Remo and the rest of the one days in Belgium. Very similar to previous years, but I've got a feeling it's going to be good. I've got a good, I don't want to speak too soon.
You don't want to jinx it, but you've got a feeling it's going to be
I'm really excited.
Excellent. Well, we've got our fingers crossed for you as well. Fred, just tell me, I guess you're not at sort of team HQ, all of the teams have a sort of base for the classics in Belgium, usually a hotel they go back to year after year. Are you already there for this weekend or?
Yeah, we're already.
And where is that?
Our team do a great job. It's like one of the best things about the classics, and what I've loved the past couple of years is they rent out this massive big villa just really close to it's quite close to the sort of running from Kerner to Kortrijk. So yeah, close to Kortrijk, this big villa, then some staff stay in the villa as well. We got a chef here, everyone's kind of chills out together. It's so much nicer basically than being in a hotel and sitting in a hotel room, because you can sort of muck around with your teammates a little bit. So
pool parties, and we're here already, so Sounds fantastic. What's that? Pool parties, yeah, DJ, it's, saunas.
Yeah, it's
sounds fantastic.
It's, no, it's great. It's really, it really kind of, I think this team, we're really sort of building something with these classics races. I think it's going to be a good one.
Interesting from Fred there. Big season for him. Bahrain Victorious will be strong, I think, at the weekend. Mohorič in particular in Omloop, Het Nieuwsblad. Rob, Koerner the following day, usually it finishes in a sprint.
We say not that. Always. We say that. It's been it's been a lot more tactical in the last few years. And the difference for anybody who doesn't know the two races that well, you know, a lot of the, you sort of build a crescendo with the climbs, don't you, in the Omloop at Nieuwsblad, and then you've got the final few kilometres on the flat. It didn't always used to be like that. When it finished in Ghent, you had the final sort of 20Ks on the flat. Now with Koerner, most of the last 50Ks. Are on the flat, really, and unless you count the Tiefenberg and things like that towards the end. A lot of climbing, most of it in the first half, but it still gets very tactical, still gets very technical. The wind, because you're doing a lap of Koerner itself as well. And last year, it was Thijs Benoot that won it. And of course, not known for his sprinting abilities, is he? And it was a lovely moment because he's a rider who obviously promised a lot. He burst onto the scene with that Tour of Flanders positioned in the early in his career, top five, I think it was on his debut or something silly like that. And then he revealed that he wrote a school essay a few years before saying that he was going to win the Tour of Flanders in 10 years. So, you know, he's had that pressure put on himself since he was a teenager. But joking aside, it was lovely to see him win his first race in Belgium, just down the road from where he's from, but half an hour from Ghent, where he's from. So anybody can win this race, and it does get technical.
I often think that's ultimately why I didn't make it as a professional sportsman. That I never. How many professional sportsmen and women do you read about or hear about who told their teacher at some point, I am going to be a footballer, cyclist, a cricketer? And I never did that. And that is probably the only thing.
That's why you went wrong.
Me from becoming. Yeah.
I knew Steve Grizovic was going to be Daniel Freeba.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, well. Omloop at the weekend, Koerner as well in Belgium. Much further south in Europe. We've talked about Visma, Lisa Bike, and how strong they're going to be in Belgium, but much further south. Their other sort of team, their other division, their stage race division, is going to be converging on the region of Galicia in northwest Spain for El Gran Camino, the third edition of that four-stage race. And Jonas Vingegaard is going to be starting his season, and it's a very hilly course. It's a good field as well. David Gaudu is also going to be there. Carlos Rodriguez will be there. Egan Bernal, Rigoberto Urán, Nielsen Paulus, Visma, Lisa Bike, as well as Vingegaard. They're going to be fielding Ben Tulet and Kian Utebrooks, both making their debuts, I think, for Visma, Lisa Bike. El Gran Camino, interesting and beautiful race. It will be a beautiful race. Richard, doing a little bit of, you've been looking into the archives of the very brief
this race.
and what has gone before in Galicia?
Yeah, there was a Tour of Galicia, which was started in the 30s, went on for a bit, went on hiatus in the 80s, came back for a bit. Miguel Indurain went there once in the 90s, but then it went just to amateur only, I think, from the year 2000. And then sort of stopped, I think, due to the COVID pandemic. But this new race has come back, the big emphasis on showcasing Galicia as a place to go and visit, like quite a big sort of tourist boardy influence behind it, which, like, go there. It's fantastic. I mean, the race last year looked superb. Galicia always looks good on TV, but as a little kind of a part of Spain you might not normally go to, something a little different. It's a brilliant little part of the world, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, hilly, like, that's, I think for the first time this season, there's going to be the sort of climbs that are getting close to Grand Tour type climbs.
Yeah, sort of 5 to 7 kilometer climbs, but there are climbs, well, there's significant climbs every day.
Yeah, apart from the TT on the first day, but even that's lumpy and technical. So
you talk about Galicia is a really beautiful part of Spain. Chaps, when I think about Galicia, and Rob, you, well, you spend a lot of time in Asturias, the neighbouring Spanish region, but when I think of Galicia, I always think of eucalyptus trees. And the eucalyptus trees, which you will see if you watch O Gran Camino, I should say as well, O Gran Camino, it's named after, takes its inspiration from probably the most famous sort of tourist attraction of Galicia, which is the Camino de Santiago, the famous St. James's Way.
I was there in Santiago like last autumn. I kind of found out that the whole idea of doing a Camino, you know, doing the pilgrimage to Santiago, was, although it's given this idea of a long tradition, which it does have, has sort of really taken off as an idea in the last 30 years or so. It's amazing, kind of successful piece of marketing from the tourism industry.
And then now there is a Camino that starts from everywhere. You can walk to the end of your road wherever you live in Europe, and you will find a version.
You can go from Reading, which is I think, no disrespect to people in Reading.
You can start this afternoon. It's not far from where
exactly. I mean, I lived there for a few years, and I think culturally, quite a long way from Santiago, as well as geographically. But
Reading's not twinned with A Coruña, then.
Not as far as I know.
Chaps, just if you indulge me for a minute or two about the eucalyptus trees, you will see them, and they are beautiful. And I feel slightly guilty about thinking that and feeling that and having this attachment to the eucalyptus trees when we go to Galicia on the Vuelta, because they are such a feature of the landscape. They account for about...
are they a pest? Invasive species? Is that where
they account for about 25% of the forested area in Galicia. And they were brought to Europe and Galicia in the 19th century when a Galician monk from the town at the bottom of what will be the decisive climb on the last stage, a monk from there brought some seeds from Australia in the mid 19th century, and they have become very, very controversial in the last few years because their sort of opponents argue they're invasive, they're not indigenous, they deplete the soil, they compromise biodiversity, and they burn very easily, and they've contributed to the terrible forest fires in Galicia. The proponents of the eucalyptus say that, well, that's not the case. They're not any more volatile than, for example, pines or oaks. If they're well managed, they can contain the forest fires, in fact. But most of all, they're incredibly lucrative compared to other trees. They yield about €1,000 per hectare compared to, for example, €300 that yielded by a pine tree. They also are sort of mature and ready to start, to yield wood that can be used industrially after about 10 years, as it takes multiple decades with pines and oaks and so on. So this battle has raged over the last few years. I think there has now been a moratorium on planting eucalyptus in Galicia. Whether we see the landscape change significantly over the coming years will be interesting, because Rob, you know, the issues like this, they can often seem sort of far away and irrelevant and not that sort of visible when you go to a place. But when you go to Galicia, you cannot mistake, or you cannot avoid, the eucalyptus trees, and as I say, unfortunately, in my case, think they're rather beautiful and rather memorable.
There's someone sat listening in the next room to where I am in Asturias who's going to be laughing now, because the first time I came to see her here, I got out of the aeroplane, got the airport, and I could not believe these trees. I'm like you, they look magnificent. I absolutely loved them, and I didn't know what they were. I thought it looked like something that should come from another continent. And the story you tell there about the seeds coming from Australia, you know, sort of tallies with that. But they do have this sort of, for someone on continental Europe anyway, a sort of otherworldly look.
Indeed. Well, look out for Jonas Vingegaard, but mainly look out for the eucalyptus trees.
And one more thing, look out for Carlos Canal, rider from Movistar, moved up to World Tour this year. The third stage starts from his hometown, which is right on the Portuguese border. It's a little town that's famous for its carnival. It's in the province of Ourense. And it's famous for its carnival and for a figure who goes round the streets checking that everybody has their carnival attire on and participating properly in the festivities. I mention this because it's carnival time right now. And if you aren't dressed properly for carnival, tradition dictates that you're escorted to a closest bar to pay a fine. And a fine...
Like the UCI commissaire of
exactly.
Carnival.
Instead of 200 Swiss francs, the fine, which helpfully for the pantaya, which is the name of the person who is the enforcer, is the price of a glass of wine. So I can only imagine that the person enforcing can only do so much enforcing before they're sort of found in the corner without the carnival attire on themselves.
I think we will introduce that for mentions of track racing and cyclocross in the non-winter months on the Cycling Podcast. Charles, well, it's been a wide-ranging discussion today. Eucalyptus trees, and what else did we get to? Craig David, all sorts of other things. Very entertaining indeed. So thank you for your company. We'll be back next week. I think we've got Mitch Docker on the pod next week. And we're also in the next few days or in the next week, we're going to be telling Friends of the Cycling Podcast what they've got in store as far as extra episodes, special benefits over the next few months. But in the meantime, enjoy your happy Omloop day, everyone. Please, please, on Monday, don't send me text saying only 364 days until Omloop. It's probably not quite that. There's also a leap year this year, so that will complicate things. Anyway, Rob, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ciao.
And Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.